From ransomware attacks to supply chain compromises, the CyberTalks podcast will dive into the world of the latest cyber threats and attacks impacting businesses globally. Join us as we speak with industry leaders and practitioners about the cyber risks impacting their business and how they're addressing these challenges. CyberTalks is presented by eSentire, the authority in managed detection and response. To learn how eSentire can help your team reduce your cyber risks and build a more resilient security operation, visit eSentire.com. I'm one of your hosts, Spence Hutchinson, Staff Threat Intelligence Researcher here at eSentire. Today, I have Keegan and Joe with me, and we're going to be discussing a pretty hot topic, the ELF Black Hat ransomware gang. So they've been in the news a lot lately, thanks to the recent ransomware attack on Change Healthcare. That one ended up resulting in widespread disruptions to healthcare services and allegedly resulted in that victim organization paying a pretty substantial extortion payment of $22 million. So we're going to get into a lot more in the episode, but we're also going to discuss an affiliate that's claiming that Black Hat cheated them out of their share of the $22 million ransom. Now, these are pretty serious claims, really in a world where reputation and credibility carry a lot of weight, and I'm looking forward to breaking this down with you both. Let's go ahead and get started. Now, before we get into ELF and Black Hat, let's do a quick round of intro so our audience knows who you both are. Keegan, why don't you start us off?
I'm a senior threat researcher on the threat intel team. I wear a couple different hats, but one of my primary goals is kind of integrating and synthesizing a lot of different intelligence sources and putting some analysis on it. And that can be, you know, more general trends in TTPs, but sometimes we get on to threat actors and track them a little bit, like ELF and some of their affiliates.
Great. Thanks, Egan. Joe, what about yourself?
Oh, I'm a principal threat researcher with the True team. And what I do is basically search for the latest and greatest threats and try and break them down, try to track threat actors, do attribution where possible. Reverse engineer malware is needed, build honeypots, sandboxes, you know, anything it takes to analyze, you know, these guys' activity and their tactics and procedures.
Excellent. So, Joe, I'll start with you on this. And why don't we really go back to the beginning? Give us the lowdown on ELF Black Hat. Who is this group and how long have they been operating?
Well, you know, it's a ransomware gang. It's actually a ransomware as a service model that they employ. And ELF, also known as Black Cat, you know, ELF is the name I think that they gave themselves. Black Cat is just, I think, a name that researchers gave them based on their early logo, which was a you know, picture of a black cat. And, you know, it's been posited that, you know, this group was actually formed out of earlier ransomware groups, namely Dark Matter Black Matter and Dark. You know, all these threat actor groups that are into ransomware always have black or dark in their name, so it gets a little bit muddy there. But yeah, in their current incarnation, they emerged around the end of 2021, and you know they got some attention right off the bat because they released their ransomware that was written in Rust. Which was a first for ransomware attacks. And, you know, they probably did that for a number of reasons. Obviously, Rust has, you know, higher performance and memory safety, but I'm thinking that it was just that, you know, Rust being so new and there are not a lot of tools out there to aid reverse engineers in picking it apart. It is a little bit tricky to reverse engineer because of all the features of the language, like the memory safety. So that's probably why they went down that route. And then the other thing we know about them, you know, they've been pretty aggressive, you know, going after high profile targets. They use the double and sometimes triple extortion model, where you know they'll steal the victim's data to try to ransom it back to them. They'll encrypt the victim's files, and sometimes they've even gone so far as to threaten denial of service attacks against the victim to entice them to pay quicker. So yeah, they've gone after everybody in government, healthcare, industry, financial services, legal, manufacturing, everything really across the board. And so, you know, this is one of these kind of high profile groups that everybody is probably seen. You know, one of the top ranking groups. Again, very threatening. In the beginning, you know, we didn't see them go after healthcare as much. But you know, after the FBI did a takedown on them, you know, we started seeing that shortly after they came back online. So definitely a group that basically said, look, the gloves are off now, and you know, we're just going to go after anybody we want. Been quite aggressive about it.
Great. Thank you for that overview. Now, in November of 2023, we actually published a report about Elfi, Black Hat, affiliates that were attacking corporations and public entities in the Americas and Europe. So that report also dove into their attempts to breach a law firm, a manufacturer, and a warehouse provider. Keegan, can you go into some of the research that you've done on these affiliates, maybe share some of the key takeaways or interesting facts?
Yeah, so kind of given the long lineage that Joe was talking about there, you know, there's some speculation they sort of originated out of Revil and then through DarkSide and Black Matter, sort of in that kind of subculture of cyber criminals. They've gathered a lot of loyal affiliates, and they tend to span the gamut from like VPN access, where they're using legitimate credentials, and social engineering. Probably the most popular example of that was Scattered Spider with the MGM attack. Exploitation, of course, as new 0 days become available, they're going to be jumping on those. Some of their affiliates will. But then we also see kind of an interesting new initial access vector that we've seen at East Entire. Probably we've been talking about it for the last 2 years, I would say, where these drive-by downloads, as we used to call them, or browser downloads nowadays, where users are just going out and browsing the internet for something they want, and they end up downloading malware and executing it. That's really starting to take off as a dominant vector, compared to, say, email was pretty much the dominant vector before that, spam email. And surprisingly, two of the initial access vectors that do this that we've been tracking ended up leading to Elfi. In particular, there was Nitrogen, which leveraged essentially Google Ads, malvertising, as we call it. And they would essentially get in front of people searching for free software. So you're looking for Slack, or you're an admin looking for an IP scanner. You'll get these fake ads that have been taken out by threat actors, and you'll end up downloading this Nitrogen malware instead. We kind of first reported on and named the Nitrogen malware back in June 2023 when we first saw it. And it has a pretty interesting method of execution. It uses Python libraries, and it uses these executable versions of a Python library that essentially you can make Windows binaries with. And it has several layers of obfuscation, takes a lot of time to reverse. Somebody spent a lot of time wrapping this up. And that was an interesting new malware that was having a lot of success and leading to Elfi. And targeting, you know, law and manufacturing. And then the other browser-based download that we see a lot is a malware called Gootloader. This one tends to target many industries, but about half of their infections, I would say, are legal industries, specifically because their tactic for getting into organizations is essentially to flood the internet with a bunch of fake agreement examples. So now when a paralegal or any kind of legal worker goes and looks for these agreement templates, they're going to end up grabbing that bootloader malware, downloading it. Now they've got the beaconing bot. And then sooner or later, some of those infections end up leading to Alfie ransomware. So we've kind of seen this interesting shift over to these browser-based downloads be very successful. You know, it's not just some annoying virus you're downloading that you got to reboot your computer or wipe your computer. These are a route for hands-on attackers to get in and deploy ransomware now just from browsing the web and downloading stuff. So we've kind of pivoted our tactics to looking at the execution chain and writing detections around those in the True team. And we continue to track the threat actors associated with Alfie to look out for these mutating tactics as the threatscape evolves.
Yeah, thanks, Keen. And I think that really speaks to like the wide array of like possible, you know, entry vectors that a ransomware as a service type or operation can take advantage of, because they're essentially motivating people to go find the latest and greatest way of breaking into organizations, because they're going to just monetize that with, you know, the ransomware that they're getting a cut from.
Yeah, exactly. And they're making so much money now, they can afford to spend that R&D and do that and be on the frontier of initial access.
Yeah, and that really makes it difficult for defenders, because you need to look really everywhere now and patch a lot of holes and monitor things. And we'll certainly get to some of those recommendations in a little bit. So I guess before we get into, we kind of talked about the takedown of Black Hat's operations. Before we get into that, we should talk about the actual ransomware attack that one of their affiliates conducted on Change Healthcare. That again, like we said, led to that that alleged $22 million ransom being paid by that victim organization. So really, for those in the audience who may not know the details of that particular attack, kind of give us some backstory on exactly what happened in that attack. And, you know, I'll kind of put that up for either Joe or Keegan to answer.
So the initial access for that one's not clear. There was a lot of speculation, kind of going over that's essentially the affiliate methods I've mentioned so far. But the impact was probably the most prominent feature of that attack, because Health Change, as some people may know, is the payment system for a lot of healthcare systems, and that it equates to about 1/3 of patients that are going to be making payments inevitably through Change Healthcare. So once the system went down, the impact was huge. I think estimates were around like 100 million a day they were hemorrhaging. So that 22 million payout that they may or may not have paid really was not the biggest loss to them. So you have to think about that sometimes when people are paying off ransomware groups, that the downtime is often can be more costly than the ransom itself.
Yep. And especially when there's, you know, people's health and potentially even lives at stake, that equation becomes a lot more difficult.
Absolutely.
So I know, as kind of a follow-up there, I know some ransomware groups generally have had, I would say, an unwritten rule about targeting sensitive victims like healthcare, hospitals, etc. Usually that, you know, that's done to avoid any kind of retribution, sort of fly under the radar. Why, like, what changed here? Why did we see this affiliate go after Change Healthcare? Maybe Joe, I know you kind of spoke to this a little bit. Maybe just go back to that point. Like, you know, why was this like an explicit instruction for them to go after healthcare? What kind of changed?
Yeah. And so back in December, when the FBI seized the Alfie Onion site, they brought it up. They're basically still had control over their Onion routing key, and basically were able to bring the site back online long enough to, you know, point the interested affiliates to their new Onion page. But they also put up a message there, and they said, you know, look, you know, after this takedown, You know, it's open season. Basically, you can go after anything you want. Critical infrastructure, fine. Hospitals, healthcare, fine. You know, so they gave their affiliates permission at that point to go out and cause as much damage as they could wherever they could.
Yeah, and why do you think that is? Is it that kind of like retribution, payback to law enforcement?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I mean, that definitely, you know, that definitely you know, damages their reputation to a certain extent. To have their infrastructure seized, and you know, it means that affiliates might become nervous, right, and want to jump ship because you know they're worried that what kind of information might the FBI have on me, and you know, am I going to be able to travel out of Russia in the near future without you know being arrested? So, I think there's times that you know some of these affiliates in the past have gone after healthcare and critical infrastructure. And maybe they're basically signaling those guys to say, hey, come back in. And, you know, we weren't going to let you do this before, but, you know, we want to make sure that our name is still out there and we're still, you know, high profile. So go ahead and attack those entities.
Yeah. And definitely a big reason, you know, we're talking about talking today, you know, is some of the recent activity around law enforcement actions, you know, against groups like Elfie and Black Hat, and even more recently, Lockbit. You know, like you said, Joe, back in December, the FBI infiltrated Elfie, Black Hat, took, you know, seized their dark website, and you know, released a decryption tool for a certain amount of their victims. I mean, considering the Change Healthcare attack occurred in February, it would seem that this group is still active. But you know, there's a bit of confusion currently because the group has now gone public to state that they are ceasing their operations because of law enforcement. Joe, can you kind of walk us through the situation? Is there any truth to the latest takedown claims by Elfie Black Hat?
I don't think so. I think they'd like to blame it on the FBI. I mean, that makes them look a little bit better than, you know, what the truth probably is, which is that they just decided to exit scam. And take their affiliates' money. So, you know, they put up a fake version of the FBI's seizure page. And we know it's fake because if you look at the HTML source, you can see that this isn't the original copy that the FBI usually puts up. In fact, this is actually a copy that was made in Firefox by, you know, right-clicking on the page and, you know, saying save page as, and then it stores the files in kind of a different layout than actually exists on the website, just to make it more compact and easier to transfer. But yeah, it has the hallmarks specifically of the Firefox browser, the way it saves the web page when you go to copy it. And so other than that, I mean, it looks identical to the original takedown page from December. But yeah, it's just incredibly obvious that somebody just did this to try to fake out the affiliates or anybody who just happened to stumble on the page and think, oh, yeah, these guys are out of business now, when clearly they might be out of business, but you know, they might have chosen to go out of business for this prior mentioned reason.
Yeah, pretty interesting. I think too, one of the law enforcement agencies came out and refuted that this wasn't them. I think it might have been a UK-based agency, if I recall correctly, that was part of that initial joint operation. So we kind of, I think we talked about this exit scam and the individual affiliate or kind of getting swindled out of their money. Joe, are you able to kind of give more background on what happened in that situation with Nachi?
Oh yeah. So basically, this affiliate named Nachi opened up basically a dispute thread on the underground forums, and you know, this is always great. I mean, we love it as researchers when these guys get in disputes with each other because they frequently leak information, because otherwise we would have no idea that, you know, Nachi was the name of the affiliate responsible for the Change Healthcare attack. But, you know, it basically came out and said, yeah, we did it. You know, the victim paid, but we didn't get our cut. And so there was some back and forth between the, you know, ALF-V administration and Nachi saying, you know, oh, yeah, don't worry. You know, when our admin comes online, you know, everything will be paid. Everything will get sorted out. And no, shortly later, they put up the seizure page. I think Nachi's not terribly happy.
Yeah, definitely. And what's kind of the, what do you think the implications of this are when it comes to, like, does Nachi, presumably he still has the data that was stolen if he didn't receive payment? Like, can you kind of speak to the implications there when it comes to Change Healthcare and potentially their partners?
Yeah. So, you know, from Change Healthcare's point of view, and they haven't, you know, admitted that they paid the ransom, but I mean, somebody paid $22 million to that Bitcoin wallet, and, you know, it's not good for them, because Nachi is probably still going to want to get paid, still has the data. So there's no reason for Nachi not to just continue with the extortion demands, in a side channel against Change Healthcare to try and get them to pay more. That's one impact to it. I mean, the other impact to the other parts of the ecosystem are that, you know, these groups go through frequent rebrandings, right? They do that all the time, I think, to take the heat off. But when one exits scams like this, I mean, it's going to be really hard to just rebrand if anybody's able to make any connection with the prior malware or any of the accounts that were involved in peddling the service at all. Because, you know, the rest of the cybercrime ecosystem, around ransomware is lost all trust in them, right? I mean, that's a lot of money to walk away from. It'll be interesting to see if they do try to just completely rebrand and do it successfully with maintaining full OPSEC. I mean, obviously, they probably don't want to write their next ransomware on Rust. It'll be interesting to see what the fallout from all of this is.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's interesting, too, when you think about the fact that Nachi still has all that data, it makes you wonder what other affiliates working with other ransomware groups, you know, also are holding on to data for a future point to perhaps try and extort. You know, I personally don't put a lot of trust into these operations actually deleting data when they say they do. But that's another podcast. Ransomware groups, you talked about potential rebranding or trying to reemerge. You know, we know they will often do this. I mean, that's how Alfie Black Hat came to be, they might come out and change tactics to evade law enforcement and cybersecurity firms. You know, Keegan, based on your experience, what are some of the signs that potentially a group is preparing to, you know, look to rebrand or even pull an exit scam like Alfie Black Hat is likely done here?
So rebranding, I would say you could divide, of course, these two cases can co-occur. You can have an exit scam that leads to a rebrand. But if we take them in isolation, rebrand is essentially going to be the response of law pressure and heat score. So you start seeing law enforcement publish, write a public report about a ransomware group, then their heat score is going up. Then you see them start offering $10 million rewards for identity. Their heat score is really going up. Then they're getting in the territory where you're probably going to see seizures. You're probably going to see indictments where companies aren't going to be allowed to pay ransoms to certain groups. So they really want to keep their heat score down. And when that heat score gets too big, it's a really good motivation to rebrand. Exit scams are more opportunistic. There's just going to need to be a point where either one affiliate gets a huge, huge drop and you can grab it and run. Then you're making out with that drop. You don't have to split it with the affiliate. But then it can also be a collective pool of affiliates. All these ransomware groups have very unique payment models and systems. I think Lockbit always bragged about how, you know, the affiliate gets it first and then pays Lockbit. So they actually get control of the funds. And that's really unique to Lockbit and a reason people like Lockbit a lot as affiliates. I don't know exactly how Alfie's system works, but obviously they're sitting in control of it. And that puts them in a great position to do the exit scam when that kind of sufficient threshold of funds pile up to where it's worth it.
Thanks, Keegan. And really this one this next question is for both you guys. Are there really any common themes that we see resurfacing time and again when it comes to ransomware as a service? Like, are there emerging trends or technologies, maybe TTPs, when it comes to these groups that organizations should be aware of?
Well, I mean, they're very opportunistic, right? I mean, obviously, you know, the playbook for once they get inside your network is pretty much the same. That doesn't change really. And each affiliate kind of has their own TTPs, but you know, the way that they get in is that seems to be the way that the trends change. And so we've seen in the past lots of just, you know, phishing and malvertising as a way to get their foot in the door. But like, I think in the past year, we've really seen them start to focus on things like the enterprise file sharing applications. Like that's been a huge one this year. And it's something where these guys are just getting more and more experienced at knowing how enterprises operate, what kind of software that they use. And you know, they can go looking for these niche vulnerabilities that, you know, nobody else is really focused on because it's not, you know, something that impacts the internet at large, right? But they can find a nice foothold of maybe a few thousand organizations that use this one outdated, you know, file sharing software where, you know, they're not using, you know, PHP, or it might depend on, you know, some other kind of outdated service. And it's something they're going to be looking for more and more in the future, I think.
Yeah, I would add kind of at the strategic level, we're seeing as a service become kind of, you know, the base economic model of cybercrime, more or less. And it's becoming just a really fast growing market. People are differentiating in that market and specializing. And there's just so many diverse offerings that you can go in and you have a lot of options on how you want to run an attack, a lot of different partner and types of models, business relationships. We're seeing, you know, R&D departments and HR departments, human resource departments, you know, rising in these, you know, starting to appear in these cybercrime organizations. So really the trend I see, like at a high level, is they're really approaching corporate maturity where they're very efficient. They can turn things around. They have R&D kind of, you know, discovering the new ground, but then they have an operations team that can action and manage the ongoing stuff. And then they have all those support teams, you know, infrastructure providers, HR, you know, people to schedule vacation for you. It's essentially approaching, you know, what legitimate corporate models look like and a legitimate economy even might look like.
Yeah. Thanks for that, that perspective, both you guys. And I mean, is there anything to be said about, you know, we think of some of the better known, affiliates, like perhaps like Scattered Spider, like they seem to be focusing more on like social engineering tactics, like actually phoning in and doing social engineering over the phone, and even more so focused on like living off the land tactics. Like, what are the implications there for organizations and defenders?
Well, definitely makes things harder to detect when there's no, you know, known malware executable. Now they're using legitimate tools, legitimate logins that they've gotten through social engineering or these info stealers that tend to be collecting a lot of credentials lately. There's no black and white detection anymore. It's kind of a gray detection. You have to get a baseline and you have to look for anomalous activity outside that baseline, because now that they're using legitimate tools, it's hard to tell the difference from a legitimate user doing this thing to a cyber criminal doing this thing.
Yeah. I would say that if you're that takes more sophistication in terms of like a security program, you know, reducing your technology footprint and monitoring for like good software or known good accounts doing evil things. And I think that's putting perhaps like the smaller side of the business spectrum more at risk. And I think that's reflected in the, you know, the victims that we see, particularly like known public victims on leak sites.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you got it. There's a lot of different data sources you got to put together to do these kind of more complicated analysis to make that kind of decision. Is this malicious or not?
Yep. More, I would argue, requires at times a human in that loop to you know, look at that signal and determine if it's, you know, benign or, you know, malicious at the very least. So just to wrap things up here, you know, what tips or advice would you give to, you know, security professionals who are worried about similar threats like Elfi Black Hat? How should they go about protecting their organization?
I mean, the obvious first out of the gate, I mean, not even really security. I mean, it's just having, you know, backup and disaster recovery plans. Like, this is like just IT 101 kind of stuff. I mean, just planning for, you know, okay, well, if an attacker does get in, are they going to be able to trash my backups in any way, shape, or form, right? So just having that plan and executing and testing it. You know, that's the big part. Now, of course, you know, it's not just encrypting the data anymore, right? It's also exfiltration and extortion. So you have to, you know, look at hardening access to that data, you know, adopting like what they call zero trust architecture. So you're verifying not just users, but you're verifying devices that can access that data, using things like passkeys and FIDO2, things that, you know, are not phishable. And then, you know, don't grant access to anyone, you know, that doesn't need it, you know, principle of least privilege.
Yeah, agree on all points. Keegan, anything else you want to add to that?
So I think bringing that browser-based vector up to user awareness, most of the user awareness training I see nowadays focuses on email. Of course, a lot of email appliances are starting to reduce that attack load a lot when these browser-based attacks are coming in. And then for the sort of VPN stuff, you know, the valid credentials in general, having some kind of monitoring of user accounts and how they're being used. That's kind of where collecting a baseline gets in, because if you all of a sudden see somebody that works in Seattle most of the time all of a sudden logging in from the Netherlands or something, that's a big red flag, of course. But you need to collect that baseline in the first place. So having that kind of monitoring in place can go a long way towards detecting those more stealthy attacks. And then, of course, when it comes to the user execution side of things, endpoint monitoring will often catch this abuse of, you know, these lol bins or living off the land binaries, essentially native Windows processes that are getting abused by these threat actors. And then kind of the last thing that two more things. One of them is MFA. I see a lot of organizations getting infected, getting breached, getting hands-on attack, and MFA is on their plan for next year or something. I would bump MFA up to right now as a priority. And then the other thing is scope monitoring, making sure that as you're starting to roll out security monitoring, you know where what you're putting that on, you know what your inventory is. I've seen several times where somebody has good monitoring set up, but they've neglected three or four machines. When threat actors get on those machines, they can see there's no monitoring on them, and they can sometimes spend a day or two sitting there and setting up, collecting hashes, and getting ready. And then when they do that, it only takes them, you know, an hour or two to deploy ransomware to a lot of computers. So having that scoping and monitoring in place can catch that stuff at the early stage before threat actors start getting in and doing that staging to prepare for like the really impactful part of the attack.
Yeah, certainly. I think multi-factor authentication, and you know, there's different flavors of it and different degrees of you know, implementations, but just having that as a barrier, I think, is a significant one for attackers that you know, they need to now circumvent, and you know, even those attempts to circumvent give you an opportunity to detect. And yeah, I don't think enough organizations have fully adopted it, you know, 100% across their accounts. I think there was a Microsoft stat from a couple of years ago that was like only 28% of Microsoft users had MFA enabled or something. So we still have a ways to go you know, as an industry to implement these barriers. But you know, every step we take is an additional cost added on to, you know, these attackers. Joe, Keegan, thank you for the time today. It was a great discussion, and I hope we can discuss more again.
Thank you. Cheers.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Spence.
To learn how eSentire can help your team reduce your cyber risks and build a more resilient security operation, visit eSentire.com.